The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine edition dated February 24th, 2012. Now we'll begin with the main story section. The first item is entitled, Obama's Election Year Budget. What happened? President Obama set out the economic battle lines for the presidential election this past week with a $3.8 trillion budget that emphasized spending over austerity and called for new taxes on the rich. Arguing that the country cannot cut its way to growth, Obama proposed $350 billion in new stimulus to maintain lower payroll taxes, bolster domestic manufacturing, and fix the nation's crumbling infrastructure. There would be only modest cuts to federal health care programs, about $360 billion over the next decade, and no changes to Social Security. Instead, Obama would reduce deficits by raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy by almost $2 trillion over the next 10 years. We don't begrudge success in America, Obama said, but we do expect everyone to do their fair share. Republicans vowed to block the budget and slammed the president for breaking his promise to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. The budget projects this year's shortfall at $1.3 trillion, down from about 15% from when Obama took office, and a $901 billion deficit for 2013. Instead of an America built to last, this is a plan for an America drowning in debt, said House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan. Now here's what the editorials had to say. There's a lot to like about the president's proposal, said the New York Times. He's rightly recognized that while it's important to shrink the deficit over the long term, the immediate priority is to encourage the fledgling economic recovery. If Congress were not totally dysfunctional, it would approve this budget. As it is, the plan will go nowhere because of Republicans' steadfast refusal to raise taxes on the wealthy and to spend money on vital programs. We should be glad this irresponsible document will never be passed, said the Detroit News. Instead of having the deficit, as promised, Obama plans for a fourth straight year of trillion-dollar-plus deficits, and in his next term, should he win one, would add another $3 trillion to the $5.5 trillion in new debt he's racked up so far. The budget is based on a flawed philosophy of spend now and pay later. But as Greece is verifying in the most painful way, at some point the bill must be paid. Well, now here's what the columnist said. What a crass piece of electioneering, said Yuval Levin in NationalReview.com. Obama has tried to please the Democrats' base by preserving the bloated entitlement system, even though the administration's own figures show that Social Security is already in the red and will drain the Treasury of half a trillion dollars over the coming decade. And his few deficit reduction measures are shams, such as counting $850 billion in savings from the wind-down in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though that money was never requested in the first place. If you need another reminder of why we need a new president next year, this budget is it. Actually, this is smart politics, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. Polls show that more than two-thirds of Americans favor creating jobs over reducing the deficit. This plan jams a wedge into the presidential race, putting Republicans on the side of budget cutting and casting Obama as focused on reviving the economy. As long as the economy does come back, that appears to be a winning political argument. This budget also gives Obama another weapon for bludgeoning Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, said Joshua Green in BusinessWeek.com. The multimillionaire politician has proposed cutting taxes on the wealthy rather than raising them, a tough argument to sell to voters, especially since Romney paid just 13.9% on income of more than $20 million in 2010. What a pity that federal budgets are now nothing more than political documents, said Linwood Brooks in the Chicago Tribune. As families and businesses across America know, real budgets are how we set priorities and plan for the unexpected. Yet for the past 4 years, bickering Republicans and Democrats have failed to pass a budget, while our national debt has climbed to record highs. Would it be too much to ask that Congress and the President develop a realistic budget plan and then follow it? In an election year, the answer, sadly, is yes. The next item from the main story section is entitled Santorum Moves into a Poll Lead Over Romney. What happened? Rick Santorum emerged as Mitt Romney's most serious challenger for the Republican presidential nomination this past week, with national polls showing the former Pennsylvania senator pulling into first place for the first time. Just a week after winning primary contests in Missouri, Colorado, and Minnesota, Santorum opened a small lead over Romney nationally, and more importantly, a 9-point lead in Michigan, which holds its primary on February 28th. Romney, a Detroit native whose father was governor of Michigan, had been expected to win that state easily. His alarmed campaign is now pouring $1.3 million into advertising in Michigan in hopes of halting Santorum's momentum. Romney did win both the main caucus and the straw poll at the Conservative Political Action Conference last week. In attempting to win over the CPAC audience, Romney used the word conservative, or some variant of it, 29 times in a half-hour-long speech. But he irritated many in the audience when he described himself as a severely conservative Republican governor. Santorum later accused Romney of rigging the CPAC poll by bussing in supporters and paying their entrance fees. "You reach a point where desperate people do desperate things," Santorum said. Now here's what the editorial said. Santorum's appeal isn't hard to fathom, said the Wall Street Journal. He's a social conservative who lives what he preaches, a rare commodity in this race of false political fronts. And he has also benefited from Romney's unconvincing, gaffe-prone, and relentlessly negative campaign. But if Santorum is to capture the nomination, he needs a broader governing message on how to reignite our stagnant economy. The presidency is not won by values alone. Nor will it be won by Romney's pulverizing his rivals, said National Review. The lack of enthusiasm conservatives feel for him has opened the door to Santorum, who is trying hard to become more than a social issues candidate. The GOP would benefit if voters now had a clear choice between the moderate Romney and Santorum, who has won more contests and amassed more delegates than Newt Gingrich. When Gingrich was surging, he urged Santorum to drop out so conservatives could unite behind one candidate. By the same standard, Gingrich should now endorse Santorum and exit. Now here's what the columnist said. Another week, another GOP frontrunner, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, but there's reason to believe that Santorum will last longer than the other, not Romney's. Liberals see Santorum as a backward, bigoted social conservative who sneers at gays and says working moms should stay home with their kids. But Santorum appeals to a certain kind of swing voter, white, working-class males who love guns, hate welfare, oppose free trade, and want higher taxes on the rich and corporations. Those are exactly the kind of swing voters Romney has failed to excite. It's difficult to find any Republican who's passionate about Romney, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Even his supporters say he's effective rather than inspirational. Successful presidential nominees need something solid behind their candidacy, be it a resonant personal story or a bold vision. With Romney, all you get is a puff of presidential-looking air. And the harder he tries, the less convincing he seems, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Take this, his use of the negative word severely to describe his conservatism. Severe is a word liberals use to describe conservatism, not one conservatives use about themselves. It sounds as if the candidate doth protest too much. Santorum's rise presents Romney with a real dilemma, said Ed Kilgore in the NewRepublic.com. He can't go nuclear on Santorum, as he did with Gingrich, because that negative TV ad barrage dragged down Mitt's own favorability ratings. Nonetheless, Romney maintains a huge fundraising and organizational advantage over Santorum. And in Michigan and beyond, Mitt's money may come to the rescue. Voters also will be reminded by the media, if not by Romney, that Santorum is a social issues zealot whose stance on working women, gay marriage, and abortion alarms independent voters and would energize Democrats. The Santorum surge may yet prove to be a squall. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. It's entitled The Culture War. Obama versus the Catholic Church. Some compromise, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In response to a huge backlash, the White House said last week it would amend its outrageous ruling that Catholic-affiliated schools, hospitals, and charities must provide health insurance that covers contraception, which the Catholic Church considers immoral. But then came the details. Catholic institutions that serve the general public will be allowed to opt out of paying for birth control coverage, Obama said, but their insurance companies will be required to provide contraceptive coverage to the church's employees free of charge. Huh? As Archbishop Timothy Dolan of New York pointed out, this phony accommodation is a shell game in which the church's insurers will quietly fold the cost of free contraceptives into their policies. The issue here is religious freedom, said David French in NationalReview.com. The liberal technocrats of the Obama administration are essentially telling the church it can't live its own values and must accede to compulsory participation in the sexual revolution. Nonsense, said Bill Press in the Chicago Tribune. The church has freely chosen to operate organizations in the secular world, like colleges and hospitals, employing and serving many non-Catholics. There, the rules of our society must apply. In the real world, contraception is used by 99% of women of childbearing age, and preventing unplanned pregnancies is vital to their health. Obama's priority is to protect women's health, not to enforce some outdated, anachronistic, and unrealistic policy of an out-of-touch celibate Catholic hierarchy. The bishops seem to care about only one thing, sex, and trying to stop women from engaging in it, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. Why doesn't the church hierarchy ever go to war with Republican politicians who ignore its teachings on the death penalty, war, or social justice issues like aiding the poor? Besides, the church has no legal basis for its medieval crusade against women and contraception. The Supreme Court has ruled that Native Americans and the Amish cannot claim religious exemptions from the law. We have never held that an individual's religious beliefs excuse him from compliance with an otherwise valid law, conservative Justice Antonin Scalia has written. Still, Obama's clumsy handling of this issue could threaten his entire reelection, said Keith Koffler in Politico.com. While most Catholics do use birth control, they also resent the federal government telling their church how to manage its affairs, and if Obama alienates Catholics, he's electoral toast. Obama won the Catholic vote 54% to 45% in 2008. If he loses substantial Catholic support, Obama is a one-term president. Non-Catholics don't like what Obama's doing either, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. By attempting to ram this measure down the throat of the church, he has reminded the country that his signature health care legislation involves a tyrannical expansion of government power. In the long run, this brouhaha could work to Obama's advantage, said Andrew Sullivan in Newsweek. His utterly sensible compromise has shown moderates once again that he's reasonable and pragmatic, while leaving the right with nothing to attack but contraception itself. In return, or rather in turning this into a culture war issue, my fellow Republicans are making a dangerous choice, said David Frum in thedailybeast.com. When all the shouting is over, most voters will perceive this as a debate about the morality of contraception. Everybody quite sure that's a wise debate to have? And from the controversy of the week in the main story section, we'll turn to the popular articles entitled Good Week 4 and... Excuse me for that. It's Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. That is the title of the feature that we're going to take a look at right now. Very, very popular. It was a good week for Facebook backlashes after Tommy Jordan of Albemarle, North Carolina, read his teenage daughter's expletive-ridden I Hate My Parents Facebook rant, took his daughter's laptop outside, and shot it 9 times. The YouTube video of the laptop's destruction generated 24 million views and an outpouring of parental support. It was a good week for retroactive justice after a witchcraft trial held in Germany in 1627 was reopened so that city councilmen could clear defendant Katharina Henot, who was burned at the stake. And it was a good week for bribery after Doane Community High School in Cincinnati began paying students to come to class. Our student population is 90% poverty, said school official Ken Ferrier. Money is important to them. It was a bad week for classical beauty after Italian artist Anna Utopia Giordano photoshopped famous Renaissance paintings such as The Birth of Venus to give the women thinner thighs and tummies and larger, perkier breasts. Giordano's point? Standards of beauty change. It was a bad week for democracy after a Pew Research Center study found that 1.8 million dead people are still registered to vote in various states, and 2.7 million people are registered to vote in more than one state. Another 51 million are not registered and cannot vote. And it was a bad week for Congress after a new Rasmussen poll found that 43% of Americans would rather have Congress run by a random selection of people from the phone book than by the current elected legislators. Only 5% think Congress is doing a good job. Now we'll turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for February 24th. Our first item is entitled Hawk's Journey into Adulthood. In the 1990s, it seemed like Ethan Hawke had it all, said Tom Schoen in the London Guardian. Critics praised his performance in movies like Reality Bites and Before Sunrise and hailed his wife, Uma Thurman, as Hollywood's greatest beauty. Then in 2003, his life fell apart. Hawke split from Thurman amid rumors that he'd had an affair with their two children's nanny, Ryan Shaw Hughes. Labeled a love rat by the tabloids, he moved into a New York's notoriously grungy Chelsea hotel. I call it the Black Years, said Hawke, who is 41 years old. Nothing teaches you like getting leveled, and I got leveled in my early 30s. He beat himself up over his failed marriage, having seen his own parents divorce when he was 3 years old. I put all this energy into not making the same mistakes my parents did, and I just reenacted them all. I thought I was so much smarter than everybody, and I'm not. Hawke slowly overcame his depression and in 2008 married Shaw Hughes, with whom he now has two children. He's found fatherhood easier the second time around. I'm really the right age now. I like being home, he says. When his first child was born, he was 27. I look at pictures of myself and wonder, what was I thinking? I didn't really understand what a meandering road adulthood is. The next item, the making of gay marriage's greatest foe. Maddie Gallagher has a very personal reason for her fight against gay marriage, said Mark Oppenheimer in Salon.com. While studying at Yale in the early 1980s, she became pregnant with her boyfriend's child. When Gallagher broke the news to him, he vanished. The last thing he said was, "I'll be back in 30 minutes." And then he wasn't. If that sophomore had stuck around and helped raise their son, Patrick, her life would have taken a very different path. I became a writer because I had a baby and had to make money. What she writes and campaigns about is the threat same-sex marriage poses to America. Her problem isn't with homosexuality. It's that children need a mom and a dad. In 2008, she led the effort to pass California's ballot initiative banning gay marriage, and in 2009 helped repeal the same-sex marriage law in Maine. For Gallagher, gay marriage is the ultimate symbol of the sexual revolution, which she blames for her own unplanned pregnancy and failed relationship. As a girl, I was taught to separate sex from reproduction, she says. Same-sex marriage is the end point. The institutionalization of this view of sex and marriage, and it is false. And the next item from the People's section, Harrelson's fear of the modern world. Woody Harrelson takes clean living to a whole new level, said Mike Sager in Esquire. A raw vegan and eco-radical, Harrelson, 50 years old, lives with his family on a working organic farm in Maui. He doesn't wear clothes made of synthetic materials or anything that's been washed with standard soap powder. The cleansers are 1,000 times more toxic than anything they purport to be cleaning, says Harrelson. Even sleeping on sheets in hotels washed with these detergents, I mean, I literally get nauseous. Harrelson first became aware of the hidden dangers of modern life about 3 decades ago when he was a struggling actor in New York. I was on a bus and some girl sees me blowing my nose, he says. I had acne all over my face, and she's like, "You're lactose intolerant. If you quit dairy, these symptoms will be gone in the 3 days." He gave up milk and cheese, and his zits and everything else cleared up. I started thinking to myself, "Geez, I've always been told milk does a body good. So what else are they lying about? All these things we've brought up to believe, or been brought up to believe, are just a total hoax, just bulls. Advertising, you know." Now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine, and this one is a timely one indeed. It is entitled, "A Night at the Oscars," coming up on Sunday night. The world's biggest award ceremony, which will take place this year on February 26th, that's this Sunday night, has a history of playing it safe. When did the Oscars begin? The first Academy Awards ceremony was held in May 1929 over dinner at Hollywood's Roosevelt Hotel. It was attended by 270 people, including some who paid a $5 fee as guests of those with invitations, and was hosted by silent movie actor Douglas Fairbanks, who handed out the awards in just a few minutes. The 15 winners had been disclosed 3 months earlier, and the very first Oscar, a 13-inch tall gold-plated statuette designed by MGM's art director Cedric Gibbons, had already been presented to German actor Emil Jannings, who had sailed to Europe a few weeks before. The silent movie star was actually the runner-up in the leading actor category. Celebrity dog Rin Tin Tin had picked up more votes, but was denied the award by an embarrassed Academy. How did the Oscar get its name? Legend has it that a librarian at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which awards the prizes, took a peek at a statuette and said, "Gee, he looks just like my Uncle Oscar." The name stuck, and so did the little man, which remains the single most prized award in the movie business. And this year's 84th Oscar ceremony will be much like the previous 83, with studio bosses, actors, directors, sound editors, and makeup artists doing their utmost to be called up on stage. Their fate rests on the votes of the Academy's members, whose numbers have climbed from 36 in 1927 to 5,783 today. How do you become a member? You're either invited to join after being nominated for an Oscar, or you're elected by at least two other members for your services to the film industry. Members join for life, making the Academy a large and unwieldy band. Among those in this select club are anonymous insiders, major Hollywood players like Steven Spielberg, and the occasional outlier like Mother Dolores Hart, a 73-year-old Benedictine nun who appeared opposite Elvis Presley in 1957's Loving You. How does the Academy vote? It has used the same Byzantine voting system since 1936. In Stage 1, choosing the nominees, members of the Academy's 15 branches vote in their own fields. So directors vote for Best Director, cinematographers vote for Best Cinematographer, and so on, with each voter naming five choices in order of preference. Everyone gets to nominate for Best Picture. Using a complex system to weight the votes, auditing firm PricewaterhouseCoopers then tabulates the results and determines the top five nominees in each category, or the top nine in the case of the Best Picture. Stage 2, choosing the winner, is simpler. All members are allowed to vote in each category, and the nominee with the most ballots wins the statuette. What's wrong with the system? Not only is it confusing, even to the members of the Academy, it produces some very puzzling results. The movie industry's most prestigious honor somehow managed to elude Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock, Richard Burton, Cary Grant, and Greta Garbo. Academy voters chose How Green Was My Valley over Citizen Kane in 1942, and Rocky ahead of Taxi Driver in 1977. Critics of the Oscars say the Academy's voters routinely discriminate against certain genres, comedies, science fiction, and westerns, and shrink from any kind of controversy and brave filmmaking, instead favoring strong, crowd-pleasing storylines. Popularity, in other words, often trumps art. How is the system to blame? Well, the biggest problem is that the average Academy winner is 57, white, male, and looking for his next Hollywood project. Only a minority, some 1,500, are actors or directors. The rest are the producers, set builders, visual effects specialists, sound guys, and PR execs that make the industry tick. They're known as the steak eaters because they're mostly red-blooded males, and when it comes to the decisive second round of voting, they are by far the Academy's largest voting bloc. Call it the steak eater vote, call it the old geezer vote, call it the babe vote. They always vote for the babes, says Jeffrey Wells, who runs HollywoodElsewhere.com. Steak eaters are not big fans of films with gay or foreign themes, like Brokeback Mountain or Munich. And in any given year, about 700 of them will be associated with an Oscar-nominated film, quietly lobbying their peers on its behalf. Does winning matter? You bet. In crude financial terms, winning an Oscar, or even being nominated, can have a huge effect on a film's success. U.S. ticket sales for Slumdog Millionaire jumped more than 200% when it was nominated in 2009. Studies have shown that nominations alone can extend a film's presence in cinemas for weeks. At the real business end of Hollywood, however, Oscars are a bonus but don't massively boost the grosses of box office smashes. Of the top 50 grossing films of all time, just three have won Best Picture: Titanic, Forrest Gump, and The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. And in a related story, how to win an Oscar. When it comes to winning an Academy Award, it pays to be a drama queen. A study by the University of California, Los Angeles, and Harvard University found that performers who appear in a drama rather than a comedy are 9 times more likely to be nominated for an award, and actresses are twice as likely to be nominated as their male co-stars. Because there are fewer female than male performers in films, and both are eligible for the same number of awards, actresses stand a better chance, said sociologist Nicole Esparza. It's simple arithmetic. Perversely, not showing up at the ceremony, a sure sign that you're an established megastar, can also improve your chances. Marlon Brando didn't pick up his Oscar for The Godfather in 1973. Paul Newman turned down an invite in 1987, convinced he wouldn't win on his 7th attempt. And when Woody Allen's Annie Hall won Best Picture in 1978, he was already tucked into bed in New York, having unplugged the phone and soothed himself to sleep by reading Conversations with Carl Jung. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for February 24th, 2012. Now we'll look at the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine for this week. The first one is entitled The Need for a Sane GOP by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Some frustrated moderates are talking about creating a third party, said Thomas Friedman, but what America really needs is a second party that offers a sane conservative alternative to the Democrats. Today's Republican Party has been hijacked by an incoherent mix of anti-government libertarians, anti-immigration activists, anti-tax fanatics, and social conservatives, all clamoring for an ideological purism that's divorced from reality. In pandering to these conflicting cliques, the GOP presidential candidates are distorting themselves into a cartoon version of Ronald Reagan, with no realistic solutions to the nation's pressing challenges. Simple math, for example, shows that we can't solve our debt crisis without raising taxes. But the GOP has cut itself off from reality by pledging to oppose all tax increases. On climate change, immigration, and the need for a government-private sector partnership to transform the economy, Republicans have adopted simplistic, radical positions, leaving the Democrats free to indulge in their own brand of magical thinking. America needs two parties to move forward into the 21st century. Sadly, one is clamoring for a return to the 19th. The next column is Iran's Next Attack Might Be Here by Mitchell Silber in the Wall Street Journal. Iran's next target could well be on American soil, said Mitchell Silber. The bombing attempts aimed at Israeli embassy personnel in India and Georgia this week may well be the beginning of an Iranian campaign to retaliate for the West's attempts to stop its nuclear program. Tehran's modus operandi is to use Hezbollah terrorists to carry out attacks, sometimes enlisting sympathetic citizens of foreign nations as accomplices. That's how Iran attacked Israeli and Jewish targets in Argentina in 1992 and 1994, killing 114 people. With its large Jewish population, New York could be high on Iran's list for subsequent attacks. In October, U.S. intelligence officials foiled a plot directed by Iran to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the U.S. by blowing up a crowded Washington, D.C. restaurant, potentially killing hundreds of Americans. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, recently warned that as tensions with the West grow, Iran's fanatical mullahs are more willing to conduct an attack in the U.S. As this week's events demonstrated, we are entering a perilous period. Iran means to make good on its threats. And our third column this week, America is Sick of War, by George Will in the Washington Post. Since 1972, Republicans have enjoyed a presumption of superiority regarding national security, said George Will. That presumption is now gone. President Obama's foreign policy has been aggressive and largely successful. Osama bin Laden is dead, and the drone war kills more terrorists every day. Yet Republicans bitterly complain that Obama is a wimp who made a terrible mistake by pulling out of Iraq and is making the same mistake by winding down Afghanistan. When he becomes president, Mitt Romney has vowed, we'll fight on in Afghanistan until the Taliban is defeated. After 10 years of war, much of it fruitless, is this really what the American people want to hear? Clearly not. Yet some Republicans are even clamoring for 2 more wars in Syria and Iran. These same hawks are in an uproar that Obama has proposed trimming the military budget by 8% over 10 years, even though the U.S. spends more on defense than the next 17 nations combined. Memo to the GOP. The voters have had quite enough of foreign nation building and want to attend to the problems at home. Republicans who think America is being endangered by appeasement and military parsimony have worked that pedal on their organ quite enough. Now from the Week magazine, we'll flip to the back of the magazine here for the section entitled The Last Word. The article this week is entitled When Cold Kills. The frigid Maine winter, says Dan Barry, can turn lethal when the fuel oil runs out. With the darkening approach of another ice-hard Saturday night in western Maine, the man on the telephone was pleading for help again. His tank was nearly dry, and he and his disabled wife needed precious heating oil to keep warm. Could Ike help out again? Ike Libby, the co-owner of a small oil company called Hometown Energy, ached for his customer, Robert Hartford. He knew that winter in Maine meant especially for a retired couple living in a wood frame house built in the 19th century, but he also knew that the Hartfords already owed him more than $700 for 2 earlier deliveries. The oil man said he was very sorry. The customer said he understood. And each was left to grapple with a matter so mundane in Maine and so vital, the need for heat. For the rest of the weekend, Libby agonized over his decision while Hartford warmed his house with the heat from his electric stove's 4 burners. You get off the phone thinking, are these people going to be found frozen, Libby said. No wonder, he said, that he is prescribed medication for stress and happy pills for equilibrium. 2 days later, Libby told his 2 office workers about his decision. Diane Carlton works the front desk while her daughter-in-law Janice handles accounts. But they share the job of worrying about Ike, whose heart, they say, is too big for his bantam size and maybe this business. The Hartford case ate him, Janice Carlton recalled. It just ate him. Libby drove off to make deliveries in his oil truck, a rolling receptacle of crumpled coffee cups and cigarette packs. Diane, the office's mother hen, went home early. This meant that Janice was alone when Hartford stepped in from the cold. He had something in his hand, the title to his 16-year-old Lincoln Town Car. Would Hometown Energy take the title as collateral for some heating oil, please? Maine was in the midst of its Republican presidential caucus, the state's wintry moment in the battle for the country's future. But at this time of year, almost nothing matters here as much as basic heat. While federal officials try to wean the country from messy and expensive heating oil, Maine remains addicted. The housing stock is old, most communities are rural, and many residents cannot afford to switch to a cleaner heat source. So the tankers pull into, say, the Portland port, the trucks load up, and the likes of Ike Libby sidle up to house after house to fill the oil tanks. This winter has been especially austere. As part of the drive to cut spending, the Obama administration and Congress have trimmed the energy assistance program that helps the poor. 65,000 households in Maine alone pay their heating bills. Eligibility is harder now, and the average amount given here is $483, down from $804 last year. At a time when the price of oil has risen more than 40 cents in a year to $3.71. As a result, Community Concepts, a community action program serving Western Maine, receives dozens of calls a day from people seeking warmth. But Dana Stevens, its director of energy and housing, says that he has distributed so much of the money reserved for emergencies that he fears running out. This means that sometimes the agency's hotline purposely goes unanswered. So Mainers try to make do. They warm up in idling cars, then dash inside and dive under the covers. They pour a few gallons of kerosene into their oil tanks and hope that it lasts. And they count on others. Maybe their pastor, maybe the delivery man, maybe even a total stranger. Hometown Energy has 5 trucks and 7 employees and is run out of an old house next to the Ellis Variety Store and Diner. Oil perfumes the place thanks to the petroleum-stained truckers and mechanics clomping through. Janice Carlton, 35, tracks accounts in the back, while Diane Carlton, 64, works in the front, where every now and then she finds herself comforting walk-ins who fear the cold so much that they cry. Their boss, Libby, 53, has rough hands and oil-stained dungarees. He has been delivering oil for most of his adult life, throwing the heavy hose over his shoulder, shoving the silver nozzle into the tank, and listening for the whistle that blows when oil replaces air. 8 years ago, he and another Dixfield local, Gene Ellis, who owns that variety store next door, created Hometown Energy, a company whose logo features a painting of a church and hillside scene from just down the road. They thought that with Ike's oil sense and Gene's business sense, they'd make money. But Libby says now that he'd sell the company in a heartbeat. "You know what my dream is?" Libby asked. "To be a greeter at Walmart." This is because he sells heat, not lumber or paper or pastries. And around here, more than a few come too close to not having enough. Sure, some abuse the heating assistance program, he says, but many others live in dire need, including people he has known all his life. So Libby does what he can. Unlike many oil companies, Hometown Energy makes small deliveries and waives off most service fees. He sets up elaborate payment plans, hoping that obligations don't melt away with the spring thaw. He accepts post-dated checks, and he takes his medication. When Robert Hartford called on the after-hours line that Saturday afternoon asking for another delivery, Libby struggled to do what was right. He cannot bear the thought of people wanting for warmth, but his tendency to cut people a break is one reason Hometown Energy isn't making much money, as his understanding partner keeps gently pointing out. "I do have a heart," Libby said, but he was already on the hook for the 2 early deliveries he had made to the couple's home. What's more, he didn't even know the Hartfords. Robert and Wilma Hartford settled into the porous old house just outside Dixfield a few months ago in what was the latest of many moves in their 37-year marriage. Robert was once a stonemason who traveled from the Pacific Northwest to New England plying his trade. "Those wandering days are gone. Robert, 68, has a bad shoulder. Wilma, 71, needs a wheelchair, and the two survive on $1,200 a month. Poverty," Wilma says. "So far this year, they have received $360 in heating assistance," he said, "about a quarter of last year's allocation." Hartford said he used what extra money they had to repair broken pipes, install a cellar door, and seal various cracks with styrofoam spray that he bought at Walmart. That wasn't enough to block the cold, of course, and the 2 oil deliveries carried them only into early January. There was no oil to burn, so the cold took up residence beside the dog and the 4 cats under the velvet painting of Jesus. The couple had no choice but to run up their electric bill. They turned on the Whirlpool stove's burners and circulated the heat with a small fan. They ran the dryer's hose back into the basement to keep pipes from freezing, even when there were no clothes to dry. And just about every day, Hartford drove to a gas station and filled up a 5-gallon plastic container with $20 of kerosene. It was the only way he had. We had, he said. Finally, seeing no other option, Hartford made the hard telephone call to Hometown Energy. Panic lurked behind his every word, and every word wounded the oil man on the other end. I had a hard time saying no, Libby said, but I had to say no. When Hartford heard that no, he also heard regret. You could tell in his voice, he said. 2 days later, Hartford drove up to Hometown Energy's small office in his weathered gray Lincoln, walked inside, and made his desperate offer, the title to his car for some oil. His offer stunned Janice Carlton, the only employee present. But she remembered that someone had offered quietly to donate 50 gallons of heating oil if an emergency case walked through the door. She called that person and explained the situation. Her mother-in-law and an office mate, Diane, answered without hesitation. "Deliver the oil, and I'll pay for it," she said, which is one of the ways that Mainers make do in the cold, cold wintertime there. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Talking Points section from the edition dated February 24th, 2012. And our first item here is entitled JFK Memoir, The Seamy Side of Camelot. Everyone knows that John F. Kennedy was a compulsive, even pathological adulterer, said Timothy Noah in The New Republic, but Mimi Alford's new memoir of her affair with JFK, Once Upon a Secret, reveals our former president as an amoral creep who not only preyed on women but subjected them to extreme humiliation. On her fourth day as a White House intern, the 19-year-old social register, Ingenue, was singled out for her leering attention by JFK, who led her upstairs to his wife's bedroom and casually deflowered her. Kennedy then began a year-and-a-half-long affair with the dazzled and conflicted young woman, during which he coerced her into performing oral sex on an assistant while he watched, and later asked her to service his younger brother, Ted. Such monstrous cruelty requires further reassessment of a president we already knew to be morally compromised. The myth of Camelot could not be any more tarnishing than it has been, said Liz Smith in the Chicago Tribune. We already knew, for example, that JFK, as president, had an affair with a mafia mistress named Judith Exner and made her pregnant, and then let mob boss Sam Gonciana pay for the abortion. Sorry, Mimi, but no one really cares about yet another mistress. JFK's presidency should be assessed in its totality, said Robert Dalek in the DailyBeast.com. Yes, he was a serial adulterer, but Kennedy performed brilliantly during the Cuban Missile Crisis, forcing the Soviet Union to back down while saving the world from nuclear war. It's for that accomplishment, not his trysts, that he'll be remembered. Ah, the Camelot myth dies hard, doesn't it, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. But the still-adored Kennedy wiretapped Martin Luther King Jr., began the Vietnam War, and treated a college intern like a cheap prostitute, smuggling her like luggage on his trips abroad. Some would argue that a politician's sex life is irrelevant, said Ana Vitiana Suarez in the Miami Herald. But honesty and decency are not traits you turn off and on like a light. In the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, with the fate of the world in the balance, JFK was negotiating with Nikita Khrushchev while rushing back and forth to the White House bedroom where Alford served his needs. That's not only disgusting, it shows a disregard for the country he vowed to serve. The next item is Jeremy Lin, an unlikely hero. It's a story almost too improbable for Disney, said Bob Molinaro in the Norfolk Virginian Pilot. 2 weeks ago, Jeremy Lin was an undrafted, unknown NBA vagabond, sleeping on his brother's couch and buried deep on the bench of the struggling New York Knicks. Then the Lin sanity began. Out of sheer desperation, the Knicks finally gave the 23-year-old Lin a chance to play. He promptly led the team to 5 straight wins, averaging an astonishing 27 points and 8 assists a game, and inspiring his teammates with his guts and unselfishness. In less than a week, Lin became, with no exaggeration, the most talked-about athlete on the planet. Lin's sudden elevation to global superstardom owes something to his unlikely pedigree, said Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal. The son of Taiwanese immigrants, he's the only Asian American in the NBA and the first Harvard graduate since 1954. But make no mistake, at the center of the frenzy is an undeniable truth. Jeremy Lin can play. Somebody has to be the party pooper, said Buzz Bissinger in the DailyBeast.com, so let's cut right down to the poop. Lin got off to such a dazzling start, mostly because he was unknown. Once his opponents stop underestimating him and start figuring out the weaknesses in his game, Lin's numbers will return to earth. The cold truth, moreover, is that if Lin were black, there'd be far less excitement. The NBA and its fans have been desperate for a great white hope ever since Larry Bird retired. Lin plays into the stereotype that African Americans succeed on raw physical talent, while lighter-complected jocks succeed because of smarts and determination. This isn't about race, said Peter Vecchi in the New York Post. Lin has become such a sensation because he represents all the people who have been told since they were kids that they wouldn't amount to anything. Lin never gave up on his NBA dream, even after being cut by 2 previous teams, and his sudden rise is like an inspirational speech to nerds and underdogs everywhere. For Asian Americans, though, said Eric Liu in Time.com, there's a special thrill in seeing Lin become so universally embraced. If he continues to dazzle, Lin might well be the first Asian American whom millions of other Americans want to be. That would be a breakthrough that transcended anything that he did on the court. Our next item from the Talking Point section here is entitled Women in Battle, a Distraction for Men. The Army ain't what it used to be, said John Cushman, Jr. in the New York Times. Soldiers have been saying that for decades, and it's truer now than ever, that the Pentagon has unveiled a new policy that allows female members of the Army to take support roles alongside combat infantrymen on the front lines. Jobs such as tank mechanic, combat medic, or radio operator. The policy stops short of placing women in direct ground combat roles, even though women served in Afghanistan and Iraq have sometimes come under fire and shot back. Nonetheless, social conservatives are objecting, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Presidential candidate Rick Santorum voiced their concerns last week when he said that women serving on the front line could prove a distraction to men. Men have emotions when they see a woman in harm's way, he said. It's natural. It's very much in our culture to be protective. Santorum has a point, said Elizabeth Regentis D'Angelo in the Washington Post. As a former Navy officer, I can tell you that most military women do not want to fight on the front lines. We prefer to serve in essential support roles away from the theater of war, where our skills are often superior to men's. Why deny men and women their differences? Frontline combat isn't just any job, said Elaine Donnelly in NationalReview.com, and the military is not just another civilian equal opportunity employer. Direct combat missions demand a level of aggression and physical strength beyond the capability of almost all women. Pretending otherwise for the sake of gender equality will put lives at risk. Don't underestimate our troops, said Julia Golocki in the Washington Times. When rockets and bullets are raining down on your foxhole, you don't worry about the gender of your comrades or their sexual orientation either. American soldiers, whether male, female, gay, or straight, are highly skilled professionals trained to react responsibly under fire. The reality is that in Iraq and Afghanistan, women have already been unofficially serving in combat roles out of sheer necessity, said J. Brian Lauder in Slate.com. They've proved fully capable, which is why the Pentagon is making it official. If some male soldiers find the presence of people different from themselves troubling in some way, they'll need to get over it. Unit cohesion is just another term for personal prejudice. Now, as we reach the end of our program for this week, we'll turn to the smaller items in the talking point section. Always interesting little footnotes here. The first one does not really have a title to it, but here it is. Federal and state governments spend nearly 66 cents of every dollar in revenue on social benefits, including Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and subsidies for children, the disabled, and the unemployed. In the year 2000, by comparison, the safety net consumed about 37 cents per revenue dollar. In every presidential nominating contest so far, except for South Carolina's, GOP turnout has fallen from what it was 4 years ago, including a drop of 14% in Florida, 26% in Nevada, and 58% in Missouri. Analysts blame lukewarm enthusiasm among voters for the GOP field and the avalanche of negative ads, which tend to depress turnout. The number of pets euthanized in the United States has plummeted from some 20 million back in 1970 to about 3 million last year, even though the number of American pets has more than doubled over that period to 160 million. The biggest reason for the change is the widespread acceptance of neutering. In the U.S. military, a woman is more likely to be raped by a fellow service member than killed in action. An estimated 19,000 service members were raped in 2010. And the U.S. Postal Service lost $3.3 billion in the last quarter of 2011, a tenfold jump from that period in 2010. The U.S. Postal Service may soon run out of money. And now let's take a look at our poll watch for this week, February 24th, 2012. 54% of Americans say that President George W. Bush is most responsible for the country's economic problems, while 29% blame President Obama, 9% say both are to blame. That was from a Washington Post and ABC News poll, by the way. And in a global poll of more than 21,000 people, two-thirds of married couples or people with a significant other say their partner is their most important source of happiness. 38% said the best thing about their relationship is the sex. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.